every day when you sit down to eat, I know you think about no-nonsense nutrition, and you think, what would Blondie have told you to do today? And you know the information is always going to come back really similar. I'm always going to tell you that you need to eat more fruits and vegetables, and you need to eat less meat, especially four-legged animals. The ones that are really consuming a huge amount of our world's resources. You'll hear me tell you to eat fresh food and food as it occurs in nature. You'll hear me tell you to eat more nuts and seeds and beans and whole grains instead of flour. You'll hear me to tell you to eat more fatty fishes, at least a couple of servings of them every week. But I don't know that I've ever talked to you about the salt shaker. And so that's what I want to do today. I want to talk to you about the salt shaker because there really is a push that has begun, especially in New York City, to speak to the entire community about the relationship that's going on between excess amounts of sodium in the American diet and the disease process. You know, you want to remember that high blood pressure contributes to heart disease and to stroke, and that combination of those two conditions is the single leading killer that we have in America today. And so when we begin to look at the relationship of sodium and asking the question, are you getting too much? It's not because we're challenging the way you like your food to taste. It's because we're challenging the fact that high blood pressure, it's a symptom. It's not a disease, but it is a symptom that contributes to so much deterioration in America. And you have some control over that. And you can shake up your ideas about salt by listening to No Nonsense Nutrition. You know, it's a pinch and a dash, but it can add up pretty quickly to unhealthy levels of sodium, especially when so many foods already contain more than enough sodium. You know, I think about eating an ounce of cheese has about 400 milligrams of sodium. And you go, well, Eve, that doesn't mean anything to me. What's 400 milligrams? Well, I'm here to tell you. Take a teaspoon of salt, any salt. Pour that teaspoon and you got about 21 to 2400 milligrams of sodium. And that's absolutely the top out amount of salt that you want to get in your diet in the course of a day. Actually, the body only needs about 500 milligrams of sodium to keep doing all the things that the body needs to do with it, because sodium is, in fact, essential in small amounts. Your body needs some sodium to function properly. It helps to maintain the right balance of fluids in your body, and we're going to talk about what happens when that goes wrong. But it also helps to transmit nerve impulses. If you didn't have sodium in your diet, you couldn't move a muscle in your body. So it influences the contraction and the relaxation of muscles. You know, your kidneys are the regulators of the amount of sodium in your diet. When the sodium levels are low, your kidneys conserve them. And when the levels are high, they excrete the excess amount in the urine. And so right away, we've got to differentiate between sodium and salt, because salt is a dietary mineral that is composed primarily of sodium and chloride. It's not just sodium, it's sodium chloride. And so there's lots of different kinds of sodiums that are out there, lots of different kinds of salt. And so you might go to the store and buy the blue box that has the girl with the umbrella on it. Only one of the dozens of salts. You know, one of the few crystals that we eat regularly, besides sugar, and one of the few foods that we keep on the table to be available at every meal. When we eat it every day as a flavor enhancer or as a taste refiner, because it suppresses the perception of unpleasant bitter tastes, salt, it's hard to think of living without it. There are dozens of salts. They have colors and flavors and even aromas. So today you can go to the fancy schmancy cooking stores and you can buy pink salt and black salt and Himalayan salt and Celtic salt and sea salt and iodized and non-iodized. And oh my, how are we going to get through all those choices? Well, sodium chloride, the most common mineral that we use on the table, is embedded in rocks that erode into the ocean. And that's how we get the characteristic salinity of ocean. just like we get the characteristic salinity of tears or even blood. A little less than 1% of your blood is sodium. And so because sodium is a nutrient, we can't do it without. We can't do without it. We got to have it. But we're programmed to go after it. And so we are predisposed to covet the taste of salt. I mean, there's lots of things in the world that are bitter. There's lots of things in the world that are sweet. There's lots of things that are astringent. We have taste buds that recognize all of those things, but the only thing that the taste buds recognize as salt is salt. We covet it. People have gathered salt from the earliest times, whether they evaporated seawater or they dissolved the mineral out of the rocks. It's been taxed, monopolized, caused political rebellion, and it's intrinsically rooted in our language. From the word for salary, which was from the Roman practice of paying soldiers with salt. That's how valuable it was. When we talk about the salt of the earth, when we talk about people that are worth their salt, we see how critical this nutrient is to our culture. You know, most salt is used for food, but today's food grade salt only is a small part of the total amount that's mined or refined that ends up in food. A lot of it is used in manufacturing. It manufactures everything from plastics to compounds that are used in the chemical industry. So when we begin to understand that about half of the salt we use comes from the sea and the other half comes from the land, it's mined. I was astounded when I went to Utah and I saw the salt mines and I saw them driving the biggest dump trucks that I've ever seen inside the ground, underneath the ground, pulling these rocks out that contain sodium chloride that were at one time at the bottom of the sea, now at the top of the mountain. So when you go over to the coast of Brittany or the coast of France and you'll see seawater being captured and evaporated in open air salt pans, or today more commonly through vacuum evaporation, but they actually put the water into holding tanks right there near the edge of the ocean and allow the water to evaporate out and then gradually take that salt. It keeps getting drier and drier, but it never gets completely dried out. And this delicate kind of salt, the fleur de sel, this is harvested on the surface of these salt pools. It's called the flower of the salt, the purest sea salt. It's hand harvested, it's a small yield, and it's really the most expensive, and it's pretty gray. And you know, what we like is that pretty white stuff. That's why we refine whole grains into flour, is so that we can get pretty white flour instead of having the brown stuff that made the good whole grain bread. And so we do the same thing with salt. We take the fleur de sel and then we take another step and we evaporate more of the seawater in these open air bins, and we don't refine it. We don't change it. We don't wash it after it's processed. So there's still algae and clay and other sea silt and trace minerals and such that are in there. In fact, when we look at unrefined sea salt, about 84% of it is sodium and the rest of it are these trace minerals. And a lot of people have ascribed tremendous benefits to these trace minerals, and I really can't deny it. When I look today at the fact that so much of the land that is used for growing food has been demineralized, we've pulled a lot of the minerals out of that soil, and even when people are growing organically, they're not necessarily replacing those minerals in the soil. And so some of these trace minerals, the things that are more obscure that you don't hear so much about, like boron and chromium and manganese, it's hard for us to get them in the food because they're not in the soil. If they're not in the soil, they can't be in the food. So these are some of the things that we can get from fleur de sel or unrefined sea salt. But sometimes it's just called gray salt because they have this gray cast to them as a result of these impurities that are still present in there. There's flavored salts, you know, garlic powder and onion powder and celery seed and things like that. There's smoked salt, which I really enjoyed. The black salt of India, the red and black Hawaiian sea salts, all of those things. You know, you put a little bit of lava rock in there and you got black salt. You know, some people speak about kosher salt, which is just a combination of coarsely ground crystal and flake salt. It's named so because it's used in kosher butchering, where these large crystals draw the blood out on the surface of the meat. But flake salt, instead of crystallizing into tiny cubes, flake salt crystals are kind of flat chips. And they're made either by skimming the first crystals from the surface of the brine or literally mechanically compacting the salt crystals to flatten them out. They don't pack together very well, and so they will stay in flakes on the top of food. So when you want that, you know, particular quality of texture, you know, you can use these other varieties like flake salt. But, you know, salt fundamentally was valued as a preservative. You got to remember, we didn't have refrigeration. We didn't have freeze-dried. We didn't have, you know, boats and trains to take crops across the country in a day. So salt was used as a preservative, as a curing agent, especially in things like sausages. We had all this meat and, you know, the stuff was going to go bad, so we salted it or we made sausage out of it. When it's dissolved in water, sodium chloride, which is electrically a neutral compound, disassociates the sodium atoms and the chloride atoms. They're called electrolytes. They, because they're electrically charged, penetrate ingredients, and as a result, they change their chemistry. So we use salt primarily as a way to preserve food. So it doesn't make any difference whether we're eating Gravlax, which is a way that we salt salmon or other fishes to preserve them, or we used it in, you know, sausages and salamis and hams and all that sort of thing. That's been the fundamental reason that salt was so valuable. It kills bacteria, because it dehydrates the cells of the harmful bacteria while allowing the harmless or salt-tolerant bacteria to flourish. So the balance of salts in body fluids, which is called the electrolyte balance, is really important to sustain life. There are many electrolytes that work in tandem to regulate the fluid pressure in the body, and among them are sodium and potassium and calcium and magnesium and chloride. They remain in the fluids surrounding our cells, specifically in the plasma, which is the fluid portion in the blood. But if you ingest too much of one of these electrolytes, notably sodium, what we're talking about today, it throws the balance off. See, we've got water inside the cells. That's called intercellular water. And when we're 20 years old, our cells are all fluffed up like grapes. They're all nice and puffed up. And remember, cells don't touch each other. They're all floating in fluid. So you've got ICW, intercellular water, and ECW, extracellular water. And there has to be a balance or an osmotic pressure that takes place between these two. If you have too little sodium, then the plasma gets thin, and then the osmotic pressure inside the blood cells is greater than the pressure outside the blood cells, and the cells take in water and they burst. So literally, too little salt can kill you. Who knew that? But the opposite can take place. If we've got a situation where we've got too much sodium, we imbalance the relationship between the fluid inside the cell and outside the cell. And not only do we swell up with edema, but that pressure, that osmotic pressure that has to happen from one side to the other with potassium on one side and sodium on the other side, gets imbalanced. It can change everything in the body and help to create high blood pressure. You know, one in every five Americans, and most of them that are older than 55, have some sort of elevated blood pressure or hypertension. It's not a disease in and of itself, but it's strongly associated with conditions affecting the heart and affecting the vascular system. Hypertension usually produces no telltale symptoms. By the time that somebody comes into my clinic and they complain that they've got a headache on the top of their head, kind of like a beanie, and they say, oh, I can tell my blood pressure is up because I feel that headache, they're already in trouble. So a lot of people don't realize that they have high blood pressure because they don't have a symptom. But when people are diagnosed, it's rare that they understand what the underlying cause is. It seems incredible that a condition with no known cause and no overt symptoms receives such aggressive medical attention, because hypertension drugs are about number three in the world in terms of treatment medications. But it is so predictive of heart attack and stroke that hypertension must be addressed. Now, my goal is always to do everything we can with diet and exercises, with meditation, with non-toxic supplements, simply because there are potentials for serious side effects with some of the hypertensive drugs. Actually, two of them were recalled last week by one of the manufacturers for manufacturing, quote, difficulties. So we don't want to just have a single-minded focus of lowering blood pressure. We really want to look at the health of the whole vascular system. There's really no drugs that heal or cleanse the heart and arteries. It's really only a natural approach that can heal. But let's talk about the vascular system. It's also known as the circulatory system. And you got the heart and you got the blood vessels. And it's hard to imagine that we have 50,000 miles of blood vessels in our body. 50,000 miles, that's twice the diameter of the Earth. And you think, how in heaven's name could I have 50,000 miles of anything inside my body? I mean, even 50,000 miles of thread, how would it fit inside my body? But this network of flexible tubes that are arranged very much in a tree-like structure, from large vessels, which are the veins and the arteries, narrowing to smaller and smaller, little capillaries, little thread-like vessels, where the blood flows slowly enough to enable the exchange of gas and nutrients, gas, the oxygen, that has to be delivered to the cells. You know, you've got blood vessels in your body that are so small that red blood cells actually have to turn sideways to get through them. That's one of the reasons we want you to take fish oil, because it keeps your blood vessel, your blood platelets flexible so they can slide through these little tiny narrow capillaries. Your heart is the pump. It helps to move the blood through the vessels. And then the veins bring the carbon dioxide-filled blood from the outside tissues back to the heart. And then the heart pumps blood to the lungs, and the blood picks up the oxygen, and it releases the carbon dioxide, so you exhale it. And then the blood returns to the rest of the body through these tubes, the arteries, and delivers the oxygenated blood again. Because it's a closed-loop system, it has to have pressure in it necessary to keep the blood flowing continuously against the force of gravity. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to pump blood up to your brain. It would only go down to your feet. So achieving the proper balance of pressure is very important. So there are all sorts of things that can cause your blood pressure to drop too low and cause dizziness or fainting. Most often, those are problems that go on with the adrenal glands. But fundamentally, we measure our blood pressure with a blood pressure cuff. And by the way, if you don't have it done and you don't want to do it at the grocery store or the drugstore, you know, you can go into any fire station here in Sarasota County and they'll take your blood pressure for you. Yes, those handsome firemen will take your blood pressure for you and find out what kind of numbers you're getting. So the readings of the pressure are given as two numbers, the upper number and the lower number, the systolic and the diastolic. We're looking for the upper number to always be under 120 and the lower number to always be under 80. Those are the healthy readings. When I first got into practice, they said that anything over 140 or anything over 90 is considered hypertension. But today, if it's between 120 and 140 on your upper number, and between 80 and 90 on your lower number, you're considered pre-hypertensive. In other words, your heart is having to work harder to move blood through these tightened arteries. The hardened or less elastic or narrowed arteries are the reason that the blood pressure goes up. I mean, think about a garden hose with a brass nozzle on the end. If you twist that brass nozzle down, the pressure goes up. So as a result, the arteries really take a pounding. So when we have high blood pressure, when we have any number over 120, any number over 80, then we're in a situation where we're getting this really loud signal that our vascular function isn't working really well. Every cell in the body, from your toenail all the way to your brain, is nourished with oxygen and nutrients from the blood. And so when the blood flows properly through the circulatory system, all the processes are fueled and the toxins are removed and the blood is filtered through the liver and the kidneys. But as we age, we can damage these blood vessels, making the vessels less efficient in transporting blood. And as a result, we can contribute to hypertension and poor blood circulation. And it can be contributed to and contribute to plaque buildup in the blood vessel walls, kidney failure, leg pain, memory problems, heart attack, and stroke. You know, I've had more impact in my practice in the last couple of years talking to people about regulating their blood pressure, not by telling them about the risk of stroke and heart disease, but by telling them about the Japanese studies that indicate that even pre-hypertensive people are individuals that have more memory problems as they age. You know, it's a whole chain of events that leads to vascular disease. Only one of those is hypertension. But it's a clear risk factor, and so we want to hunt down the cause. And while there's lots of causes, there's relationships to hormones and there's relationships to chronic inflammation, but there is a tremendous relationship in terms of your blood pressure. Now, remember, blood pressure does vary upon the time of the day as well as your physical activities and your stress level. A single reading may not accurately represent your average blood pressure level. And so that's why I like using these digital blood pressure machines to check your blood pressure at home. They cost about $100. I found that the cheap ones fall apart quick and the real expensive ones just have a little chip in them that allows you to keep a memory of your prior readings. It's just as easy for you to have a little book nearby and write them down. Once you spend more than $100, you're not really getting any more bang for your buck. But when we look at the nature of how we're regulating the fluid inside the cell and outside the cell, we're going to begin to understand why the volume of salt that we eat in the diet is a contributor to hypertension. You know, excess salt consumption has been linked to asthma, especially exercise-induced asthma, heartburn, osteoporosis, gastric cancer, as well as cardiac enlargement. Left ventricular hypertrophy is clearly connected to excess amounts of sodium. Edema, fluid retention, duodenal ulcers, gastric ulcers, and actually death. In China, one of the major sources of the suicide attempts is high salt intake. So when we take in a great deal of sodium, and that's easy enough to do. Maybe you stopped this morning over at one of the local places to get a cup of coffee, and you decided to have a bagel. Well, you could have an everything bagel over at Dunkin' Donuts, and you would get 370 calories, and you would get about 650 milligrams of sodium. Remember I said we want to stop at 2,400 for the day. But you might have looked at that salt bagel that was sitting there and thinking, oh, that's pretty good. That's kind of like a pretzel. I'm going to have that. And you would have gotten 4,520 milligrams of sodium. Remember, you're supposed to stop at 2,400. So it would be easy for you to go to Mickey D's, as the kids call it, and get one of their deluxe breakfasts with three pancakes and some scrambled eggs and a hash brown and a sausage and a biscuit. And not only would you end up with 1,150 calories, but you would end up with all of the sodium that you need for the whole day, 2,260 milligrams of sodium. I mention these particular places simply because I want us to understand that the majority of the sodium that we get in our diet is from prepared food, probably 70 or 75% of it. We don't really get the majority of our sodium from the salt shaker. In fact, probably only about 6% of the total sodium that we consume comes out of the salt shaker. Another 5 or 6% we cook with. Some of it is just from natural sources. It occurs in the cheese, and it occurs in the milk, and it occurs in foods naturally, most notably meats. But 70-75% is from processed and prepared foods. So when we look at what the American Medical Association has done in terms of calling on the FDA to revoke sodium status as a generally recognized as safe compound, yeah, the GRAS list, G-R-A-S, generally recognized as safe. This was a group of compounds that were grandfathered in by the FDA about 30 years ago to say, hey, they're fine. They're generally recognized as safe. We don't have any real issues with this. But we find out that less sodium is a solution. You know, there's a tremendous hypertension prevention trial that was done. And they found out that the people that ate the least amount of sodium had a 37% reduction in heart attacks and in strokes. That's an incredible difference. But there are effects beyond blood pressure. You know, in Finland, they found a link between salt intake and obesity. So our primary goal in terms of doing sodium-saving strategies, easy for me to say, is not only to benefit the cardiovascular system and reduce your overall risk of stroke, but to realize that we have cultured ourselves to eating these incredibly salty foods. And by culturing ourselves to eating salty foods, we constantly want more of it. And so there are some of you that are salt heads out there. And those of you that are salt heads would be interested that in homeopathy, something that I practice in my clinic, it's considered that somebody that has an inordinate desire for salt actually has an inability to use it correctly. So Natrum muriaticum, which is the name, the Latin name for salt or sodium chloride, is considered to be out of balance, especially in people who are very thin, especially in the upper half of their bodies. Even though they eat well, they're from the waist up, they're still skinnier than they are from the waist down. Anytime individuals have oily perspiration, they're considered to be a natrum muriaticum type. People that are absent-minded. So when we see people that are sad and depressed and that don't like to be consoled, people that really mull over their problems, they have a craving for salt. These are individuals that we use the homeopathic remedy made from sodium chloride because we see that their bodies aren't using salt correctly, and so they keep craving more and more of it and more of it, but they can't really utilize it well. So by using it in a homeopathic form, abbreviated as the cell salt NatMur, we can actually correct some of that imbalance. And yes, correct some of the sadness and the depression and the salt craving and the absent-mindedness all at the same time. When we look at cutting sodium, what we've really got to look to is a story that I told when I went to Australia that the Campbell's Soup Company was sued by the government of Australia because their commercial was salt, listen to me, soup is good food. And the Australian government said, no, you can't advertise that soup is good food because you have over 1,000 milligrams of sodium in a serving of soup. And so this is where we're getting our salt. We're getting our sodium in prepared foods. So here's a little quiz for you. In one hand, I have an ounce of Planters cocktail peanuts. And in the other hand, I've got one of those serving cups of vanilla pudding. Which one has more sodium? Well, logic would say, absolutely, it's the salted peanuts, Eve, but I have to tell you, it's the vanilla pudding. Let's do it again. In one hand, I have an ounce of Lay's potato chips, and in the other hand, I have one single slice of Pepperidge Farm white bread. Well, you already know the answer. It's not the potato chips. It's the white bread. In fact, if you go to McDonald's or some of the other fast food joints, you'll find out that there's often more sodium in the milkshake than there is in the French fries. My point is that it doesn't have to taste salty to be salty. So we know now that the real issue are the sodium-sensitive individuals. Problem is, we don't know who they are. Sodium-sensitive individuals. Boy, there's a lot of tongue twisters in today's show. The National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute has the National High Blood Pressure Education Program. And these are academic experts on hypertension, you know, whose whole career has been about studying hypertension. And these parties have long held that it is important to restrict dietary salt as a matter of public policy. And that's what's really coming to the table now. The idea that we may need to legislate companies to reduce the amount of sodium that is in their food. On the other side is the Salt Institute, a rich and powerful manufacturers of processed foods, because these huge amounts of salt that are in processed foods are there in part to disguise poor quality ingredients, but they also add body and they reduce bitterness. So there's lots of reasons for people to use a ton of salt besides its preservative effects. And since both camps are very well entrenched, well armed, and have gone through 30 years of fighting, they're pretty battle hardened. So it's doubtful that one new scientific study is really going to change their mind. And we know that the effects of salt metabolism on high blood pressure are very complex. You know, there's been 20,000 studies that have been done on the relationship between salt and hypertension, and nobody's read them all. So there are conflicting and contradictory results, but we have seen consistently in the really large studies, especially the nurses study and the physician study, that the individuals that have the highest amount of sodium get in trouble a whole lot easier with hypertension and thereby the risk of stroke. So just reducing the amount of processed and prepared foods in the diet, which of course has always been an endorsement here on No Nonsense Nutrition. You know, when people are living on canned vegetables and soups and luncheon meat and frozen foods and, you know, takeout and fast foods, they're going to get these huge amounts of sodium. I think that the real mind blower for me as I was preparing for the show was just looking at the Chili's fajita chicken. Now, you go into a restaurant and you think, oh, I'm going to have the chicken and rice and black beans and little pico de gallo sauce on it. And man, that's going to be a healthy meal. Chicken, rice, and black beans? How could you go wrong? And yet, there were 5,300 milligrams of sodium in that single serving. So when I look at the number of people that are lined up at the Subways and the Wendy's and the Burger Kings and the Taco Bells and the Kentucky Fried Chickens, etc., and I see that so many of those meals have 2,500, 2,800, 1,700 milligrams of sodium, I have to say we're already in trouble if we've eaten even one of those meals a day. So, you know, here on No Nonsense Nutrition, we're always endorsing the DASH diet. You know, the DASH diet, the dietary approaches to stop hypertension, I've done several shows on. But the nurses' health study, you know, there's 90,000 women in the nurses' health study, and they've been doing 24 years of studying. And what they found out is that women that are the closest to the DASH diet are 25% less likely to develop heart disease and 18% less likely to have a stroke. Those are pretty dramatic numbers. You know, if we had a drug that you could take every single day that would reduce your risk of stroke by 20% and your risk of heart disease by 25%, there'd be a lot of people lined up to take it. And so when we talk about the DASH diet, which reduces both systolic and diastolic pressure, as well as unhealthy, sticky cholesterols, what we find out is that it's the same thing we talk about on No Nonsense Nutrition all the time. More fruit, more vegetables, more whole grains, more nuts and legumes, more low-fat dairy products, less red meat, less processed meat, less sweetened beverages, less sodium. Easy enough. You know, the National Institute of Health, NIH.gov, is a wonderful website. And you can get the complete DASH diet downloaded from that site. All you got to do is put in NIH.gov/health. And you're going to get a whole bunch of stuff on there. And they've got a search engine there that you can just type in the DASH diet. There is a tremendous amount of information from the DASH scores that tell us about cardiovascular disease and even tell us about obesity and diabetes. We don't know now why high sodium diets are connected to obesity. We don't understand yet all the mechanisms of action. But we do know that people that eat the highest amount of sodium not only have high rates of heart disease and high rates of hypertension and high rates of stroke, but they often have high rates of obesity and diabetes as compared to the ones that have the lowest scores. So read nutrition fact labels. You know, I love the Amy's Organic Soups, and I was so happy when they delivered the Amy's Organic Soups that were lower in sodium. Well, lower in sodium doesn't necessarily mean low sodium. You know, some of those soups still have 700 milligrams of sodium in a can. But they're lower than they would be in the high volume version. But we want to read the nutrition fact label. If you're going to buy a can of soup, just turn it over and look at the per serving dose. And then look at how many servings are in the can. Some people look at that per serving dose and it says, oh, 700 milligrams of sodium. But they don't realize that it's considered to be two servings in a can. So there's actually 1400 milligrams of sodium. You know, when you fill your salt shaker at the table, I'm not necessarily recommending that you fill it with a salt substitute because, like I said before, only 5 or 6% of all the salt that you get is coming from the salt shaker. I'm not really worried about that. Now, there are salt substitutes, New Salt and Salt Sense. Some of the research shows that they may have a benefit. Most of them are rich in potassium, which you wouldn't want to use if you had kidney disease. But moreover, if we just pay attention to our mustard and our horseradish and our red pepper sauce and our ketchup and our steak sauce and our soy sauce and our teriyaki sauce and our barbecue sauce, those are places that are usually absolutely dripping in sodium. So when we see something on the label that says reduced sodium or less sodium, it has at least 25% less than the regular version. But if it says low sodium, it means it's only got 140 milligrams or less per serving. You know, sodium-free or salt-free is less than 5 milligrams per serving. So when you cook your food as whole food, you know that nothing has been put in a processed way. So that if you turn around and you add salt to it, it's almost impossible for you to use a teaspoon a day. When I was living in Colorado before I came to my senses and moved back to Florida, I decided I would give myself a test. My grandmother had salt cellars that she used to put on the table. Common practice years ago. And so I took grandma's salt cellar and I put a teaspoon of salt in it every morning when I got up. And I salted my food liberally. I had the oatmeal for breakfast. I had eggs for breakfast. I put salt on it. I had tomatoes on my sandwich at lunch. I put salt on it. I had baked potatoes for dinner. I put salt on it. I use salt as liberally as I could through the day, even having food saltier than I really care for. There was never a day in an entire month, I did this for 31 days, that I could even eat a teaspoon of salt if it was sprinkled on the food. And yet it can be buried in these condiments and we don't even notice it. And so eating more whole foods is the way. And you say, well, Eve, you know, with the economic situation today, it's a lot easier for me to go to the dollar menu at the fast food restaurant. Talk about digging our graves with our forks. We want to begin to embrace the idea that eating healthy doesn't have to be expensive. I mean, I can make a pot of bean or lentil or pea soup that I can serve with a salad or even a toasted cheese sandwich loaded with sodium in the bread and in the cheese, and I still come up with something less than what you're going to get at the fast food joints. If we use some salty wisdom and slash sodium just by shopping smart, then we're going to have a significant sodium savings. You know, I looked at Uncle Ben's Ready Rice, and a cup of it had 770 milligrams of sodium. But if I took the Uncle Ben's whole grain rice instead of their garden vegetable variety, there was 5 milligrams of sodium. 770 versus 5. Now, I could take that Ready Rice, and I could add a handful of frozen peas and cut up a carrot and throw some corn into it, and I've got my garden vegetable Ready Rice, and I've lost 765 milligrams of sodium. You know, I looked at Progresso's traditional beef and vegetable soup, one of the most popular ones, 960 milligrams in a cup. Well, most people don't eat a cup, they eat a can, and so they would end up with almost twice that many, about 1,600 milligrams of sodium. But I found that there was a Health Valley vegetable soup that only had 390 milligrams of sodium. And even if you added your own piece of beef into it, you couldn't get up over 500 milligrams. That's a big comparison to 1,600. So as I looked at all sorts of things, frozen foods, you know, I looked at the banquet frozen turkey meal with 1,000 milligrams in an entree, and then I looked at the Healthy Choice grilled turkey frozen meal with less than half that many at 450 milligrams. I looked at regular canned chicken broth. It was almost 1,000 milligrams a cup. I looked at the organic chicken broth with 400 milligrams a cup. So there literally is not anything that you can buy in a can or a box or prepared that you can't find a better choice. Even if you're using something like deli turkey breast, you know, the Butterball deli turkey breast had twice as much sodium as compared to the Healthy Choice ham. And you would think that ham would be really high in sodium, and yet the turkey had even more sodium in it. So it isn't our issue to target particular brands. It's simply to make you aware that these are the things that you put off the pull off the shelf and throw into your basket. And every single time that you read a label, you can learn a little bit about where this sodium is buried that you don't, it just doesn't cross your mind. We haven't been trained to look for sodium levels until such time as you look at your feet one day and they're all swole up and you go, oh my gracious, I'm having edematous feet. Well, that may not be the language that you use, but your feet are swole. My ankles are swole, like one of my clients said on Saturday. Southern girl said, I'm all swole up. First thing you got to do is look at the total amount of sodium that you're getting in your diet. So when we realize that the human embryo developed in a salty fluid, that we have salty blood and we have salty lymphatic fluid and all of our extracellular fluid is salty, even of our tears are salty. And the salt really does help to carry nutrients into the cells. It does regulate a whole lot of functions that are in the body. But at the same time, excess amounts, nothing but problems, because we have to dilute the excess amount, and that actually causes us to push water out of those nice fluffy grape-like cells and dehydrate them. Our cells then become more like raisins than grapes. And you want to remember that water conducts electricity. You know, when my mother told me, don't turn on the record player if you're standing on the damp patio in your bare feet, when I was a little kid. That's the very first time I can remember ever getting an electrical shock. Well, Ma was right. Dampness does conduct electricity. Well, it does it in the cell as well. So when the cell is all fluffed up with water, it can conduct more electricity. Therefore, it can create more energy. When the cell is dehydrated, it can't conduct as much electricity. It doesn't have as much vitality. And if we have too much salt in the diet, we actually push the water from the ICW, the intercellular water, to the ECW, to the extracellular water. And we push it out in order to try to dilute the salt, and then we swell up from it. That's what the edema is. So, you know, fish can survive by excreting large amounts of salt through their gills, but we have to excrete salt through our kidney. And there's only so much that can be urinated away, and salt-sensitive individuals, especially African Americans, excrete much less sodium than normal. So the body's extremities are going to swell up if you can't reduce the salt by urinating it away. If you're not drinking enough water, the body will find the extra water it needs by robbing its own cells. When that happens, the neurons shrink, and then they begin to stretch, and then the brain and spinal membranes can hemorrhage. The brain shrinks. You know, too high of a concentration of salt in the body can lead to irritability, to muscle twitching, to seizures, to brain damage, to coma, and even to death. And so when we look at the horrendous excess of salt that we end up with every day, especially dangerous to those people that have subtle kidney problems that go undiagnosed, then we want to choose and balance the salt. So my recommendations. First off, we need the iodine that's in the salt. So when you use unrefined sea salt like Celtic or Himalayan salt, instead of the refined table salt, that is clearly superior in terms of the trace minerals. But you want to make sure that you're taking supplemental iodine. We've done shows here on No Nonsense Nutrition about iodine and its critical need. So if you're going to go buy salt, think about unrefined sea salt that's been iodized, where they've added the iodine actually back into it, because we really, really need iodine in our bodies. Remember that salt has been a tremendous part of our history, that the changes that we've made politically, economically, and culturally, in part, have been about salt, that it's a big piece of our history. But the future of salt in our history probably is going to have more to do with the perchlorate rocket fuel that we're actually finding as a contaminant in salt than the fact that the whole reason that Gandhi created the revolution in India was about the nature of the British taxing salt. So when we begin to learn about salt and sodium, the only thing I ask you to do is the same thing I ask you to do so often here on No Nonsense Nutrition, and that's think before you put it into your mouth. Realize that you can make your choices at your grocery store rather than making your choices at your table.